Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, it is time to get your geek on because we are going to get into the numbers. We're going to get into the analysis of how and why, dare I say it, the Democrats can hold the House this November. What? Did you just say that out loud? Yes, I did. You know why? Because I've got Simon Rosenberg, president of New Democrat Network and the New Policy Institute, on with me to talk about exactly how that could happen. We're going to get into all of it as we unpack the upcoming elections. And he can do that because he's a former Clinton administration staffer, a top advisor to the DCCC, their Congressional Campaign Committee. And as I said, and as you will see, he's very optimistic, somewhat bullish on a potential blue wave this November. Well, grab your pen, grab your calculator, grab your syllabus, grab whatever you need to grab. Get ready to get your geek on with me and Simon Rosenberg right here on the Michael Steele podcast after this quick break. Hey, everybody. Like I said, welcome to the podcast. And, you know, this is time to geek out because that's what we're going to do. I've got one of the best data polling geeks right now. And that is my man, Simon Rosenberg. I'm so happy you are part of our conversation because I'll just begin our conversation this way, my friend. Yeah. There was a great article that was out in early August, mid-August, actually, by Susan Glazer. And the headline was, is there a serious case for for a not awful election for Democrats this fall? And in it, she notes, quote, 7 years after Trump formally entered politics, capturing a hold on the national imagination, which remains undiminished despite defeat and disgrace, yeah, historical precedent and a full battery of metrics suggests that Trump's Republicans are poised to reap significant gains in this fall's midterm elections. The conventional wisdom in Washington would indicate that the Democrats are all but certain to lose the House in 2022 and very likely the Senate, too. Howsomever, there's this quote that sticks out there that goes, but in the age of Trump, nothing is normal. Simon Rosenberg, the president of the liberal think tank, the New Democrat Network and veteran strategist, told me, nothing is following traditional physics and rules, so why would this midterm? I begin with you, one liberal, as they put, what they call you, liberal, yeah, president, yeah, of the National Democrat Network.
Yeah,
what do you see? Because I agree with you. This is not, yeah, just a liberal thing, folks. There are conservatives like myself who see this landscape shaping up a lot differently. Simon, it's all yours.
Yeah, listen, I think that, you know, once the Republicans made a decision to run towards MAGA in record numbers, right? I mean, we had record turnout in 2018, record turnout in 2020. More people had voted against MAGA than any other political ideology in American history. And once the Republicans chose to run towards that politics, which had just failed them so miserably, it meant that this was likely to be a competitive election or an election that might not actually follow traditional midterm physics, as we call it in our business. And that's so last November, you know, I was looking around thinking that might be the case, right? Because MAGA was this force that drove the outcome of the last two elections.
Right.
And we started seeing in the data, and we've talked about this, Michael, we started seeing in the data even last fall and winter that there was what they call a decoupling between Biden's approval rating and what's called the congressional generic, which is, are you going to vote Democrat or Republican for Congress? And so my explanation for that was that, you know, people could be disappointed in Biden, but definitely not want to vote for the Republicans. They just voted against them twice in big record numbers. And so the Republicans, I think, made a huge error strategically by believing that disappointment in Biden was just going to translate into votes for them. And what was going to have to happen, right, was that something was going to have to wake up this anti-MAGA majority, that this durable anti-MAGA majority. And that's exactly what's happened over the spring and summer.
So let's unpack that a lot, a little bit more, because there is a lot of, yes, data, and we're going to get into the data, but there's a lot of top line information that I think begins to shape the argument that you have posited since springtime, really, you know, from when I first started paying closer attention to what you were tracking, because it's like, dude, this is kind of lining up with what my instincts are telling me, what I'm hearing, talking to Republicans who are sharing some polling. They're nervous. They're nervous for good reason. And you really kind of get into that because you note in a tweet that you posted, I believe, a couple of days ago, the GOP polls might be leading Donald Trump to believe, or not Donald Trump, but in this case, Mitch McConnell, who was very clear, you know, famously now, or infamously, depending on how you look at it, noting that the quality of candidates is a problem for Republicans in November. And you say that GOP polls, which might be leading him to believe this election is slipping away from the GOP, kind of revolve around four polls from influential and well-established GOP institutions. American Prosperity have Democrats plus three. Echelon Insights has Democrats plus four. Chamber of Commerce polling has Democrats plus five. Winning the Issues polling has Democrats plus six. So there is, you know, as you note, an average of 4.5 point favorites. Democrats are going into generic ballot, at least from the generic ballot. How do you see that? What does that say to you, rather?
Yeah.
I mean, how what's the messaging that not just Democrats, but Republicans should be taken away from their own polling?
So I think the Republican polling, to me, has been shockingly bad for Republicans, meaning that there's just a preponderance now of polls, you know, more than 10 taken in 10 different polls, not 10 polls, but 10 different polling outfits, showing either Democrats with a substantial lead or a substantial movement towards the Democrats. And so I think it became undeniable for Mitch McConnell and anyone who's paying attention and who's responsible in their, when they look at data and aren't polemical and propagandistic, right? I mean, anyone who's looking honestly, this showed that the election really had changed and that the combination of mass shootings and the ending of Roe, the abortion restrictions, the January 6th revelations had all congealed into this thing that was reminding voters why they had not voted Republican in the last two elections. And it was dragging down the Republican brand. You could see it in the data. And it was sudden and significant also movement right after Roe ended. There was an election in Nebraska 4 days after Roe ended on June 28th, a special election for the House, where Democrats outperformed their 2020 numbers by 10 points. I mean, that's not just not a red wave. That looks like a blue wave. I mean, when you're that far ahead of your last year's numbers, and it was, and I think everyone kind of discounted it at the time because it was seen like an odd thing, but you saw huge Democratic overperformance in a Republican state. Right. And then you saw what happened in Kansas, where we also had huge Democratic overperformance in a Republican state. And then, you know, we had Minnesota, another strong showing for the Democrats in a House special. And then last week in New York, right, we had two more demonstrations that in actual voting with real voters, right, not polling, but with real voters, Democrats were outperforming all expectations and their 2020 numbers. You know, if they're outperforming 2020, and in 2020 we won the Senate and won the presidency and won the national vote by 4.5 points, you know, that's a pretty good indicator that things, you know, that there could be a higher upper end to the Democratic performance, you know, than people are even saying at this point. I mean, my view is that we're up by 2 or 3 points right now. Most analysts believe that we have to be up by at least that margin to put the House into play. So to me, it just means that the Senate today is leading Democrat. The House is in play, right? It could go either way. I mean, it's going to be competitive until the final day. And that I think Democrats have, you know, a fundraising advantage with their candidates. We feel like we've got momentum. We're closing strong. And as we've discussed, Michael, the Republicans are closing as ugly as you could possibly imagine with all these Trump revelations, the crime, you know, the stories about 10-year-old girls having to give birth. I mean, it's just a incredible set of ugly stories about the Republican Party, not in any way the way they hope to be closing out this election.
In fact, you note in a number of the pieces that you've put out and the data showing, you can't even find Republicans at 50% right now.
This is a really, this is something that I think hasn't gotten nearly enough attention, and I don't really understand why, right? Because what you look around the country, and part of the way that I got to this place that I was at is that we did a series of polls in mid-May of Hispanic voters in Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. And, you know, I've worked a lot in the Hispanic community over the last 20 years. I was always a little doubtful that the Hispanics were running towards the Republicans. There didn't seem to really be a compelling reason why. So some of us who had worked together on these issues raised a bunch of money, and we went into the field to see what was going on. And what we came back with was Democrats overperforming their 2020 numbers, similar to what happened in these elections, right? I mean, we were doing better in 2020. Republicans were doing worse. I was really surprised by these findings. And so I started really going into the data that was publicly available in 538 and other places. And what you found across the country in late May to mid-June were Democrats overperforming or being where they wanted to be, right? Comfortably where they wanted to be, and Republicans below where they wanted to be. And so the story kept being the same, right? Wherever in our polling in Hispanics, in national public polling, in the votes that have taken place, you know, where you've seen Democratic overperformance, Republican underperformance. And so today, if you just go to 538, it's incredibly difficult to find any Republican in a competitive race in a comfortable position or anywhere close to 50. I mean, today was the third poll taken in North Carolina in the last 2 weeks where Bud, the Republican candidate, was at 42 or below.
Wow.
We know that Oz has been, you know, closer to 40 than 45. Ron Johnson's been closer to 40 than 45. You know, we just saw a poll today in Colorado where the Republican candidate was under 40 in for the Senate. And so, and in, we know that in Arizona, Kelly's up by 8 to 10 points in all the polls. And so even Marco Rubio, let me give you another one. I mean, Rubio is sort of the one that I think you really have to keep an eye on here. He's been at 44, 45, 46, not even at 50. Rubio, by the way, has never got to 50 in his previous two elections. And so he's always needed a third party intervention in order to help him win. And so when you look at this stuff, honestly, what you're seeing is, you know, Democrats are doing pretty good. You know, we'll take it, right? And Republicans are not where they want to be in race after race all across the country. Let me tell you something I just read about before I came on with you is that a Democratic group is now running ads now in Iowa against Grassley. So Democrats are now spending money in Iowa, right, in a race that nobody's paying attention to. But why? Because Grassley's been under 50 in every public poll taken in Iowa in the last few months. And so I call it the MAGA hangover. I think there was always downward pressure on the Republican brand. People were uncertain of them because of January 6th, all these things we've talked about. And so, you know, it's very possible that this could be not just a close competitive election for Democrats, but we could actually have a good election. There is, you know, let's say a third chance, or, you know, if you scenario plan, you know, one third chance now that Democrats can win this election by 4 or 5 points, not just a point or two, right? And I think that certainly my view is that as we head towards the election, things are likely to get much more likely to get better for Democrats than they are to get better for Republicans.
It's funny, you know, that MAGA hangover is the worst weekend at Bernie's you can ever have, right? It is absolutely not only is there one dead body, there are many dead bodies at that party, and you just ask yourself, how the hell did I get here, and when can I go home? Yeah. And I think a lot of Americans are now, you know, like Dorothy, you know, sitting there, there's no place like home, you know, clicking their heels. And that's being reflected in the polling. In fact, you and I have talked about the fact that And you actually noted in a memo that you published, memo number three, reasons why 2022 won't be like 2010. I advise everybody to go check that out, because it does lay down a lot of the baseline understanding of the difference between the environment in 2010, which I know very well for a lot of personal reasons, and some of the strategies that I employed understanding the landscape as it was changing around the idea of a government, as I framed it, a government takeover of our national healthcare system. Yeah. And the public was, by and large, nah, we don't want that. And I would later confess to Nancy Pelosi, yeah, I won that battle, but you ultimately won the war on that.
Yeah.
And what we see now in 2022, where MAGA is that thing that has grabbed the attention of the American voter, despite the bad polling numbers for the president, which are improving, is now over, a little bit over 40. The bad polling numbers, as you discussed, and we'll get into even a little bit more deeply, that Republicans are confronting with the quality of candidates that they put on the table. Yep. Tell us why this time is not 2010. And how you see the difference playing out as you look at the next 8 weeks going into the November election and the polling for Democrats and Republicans relative to this idea that, no, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is not 2010 for Republicans.
Yeah. I mean, I think the central reason why was that this decision by the Republicans to run towards MAGA, right? I mean, in the last two elections, I don't know if people really know this, but we won those two elections by an average of 6.5 points. That's a big margin.
It's a big margin, Yeah,
these are very, very high turnout elections.
And can so just an, real quick, hold that thought, because I think it's important to note that 6.5 points translates into millions of voters. I mean, so you're not, a lot of people kind of think, it's, oh, well, that's not a big number. It's 6.5 points. No, so that's millions of voters.
Well, let me give you the number. In 2018, we won the election by 10 million votes. And in 2020, we won it by 7.5 million votes, right? So we're talking about, you know, we got 52% plus in those two elections on average. Republicans only got 46. And so the question was, if they only got 46 in the last two elections running as MAGA, and then they run as MAGA again, why did they expect their numbers to go up, right? There had already been a judgment on MAGA, you know, and a durable anti-MAGA majority. And what we're seeing is that it's not clear the Republicans can even get to 46 this time, right? Is because you're seeing the Republican coalition splinter. Liz Cheney is going to be campaigning with Democrats. Yesterday you saw in Pennsylvania a whole series of very prominent Republicans endorse the Democratic governor. These are things, Michael, that you know very well. We never see in our business, right?
And I'll be honest, I'm going to be active in the Evan Mullen campaign against Mike Lee in Utah. You're going to see folks like me in a number of races across the board. So you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. And so if all of your work, you know, former RNC chairman and Liz Cheney, who's daughter of a Republican vice president, and Bill Kristol, whose organization is running $10 million worth of ads from Republicans telling other Republicans not to vote Republican, if all of that work shaves off a point or two, right, then you're talking about the
Republicans. 46 is not 46.
And 46 is not 46, which means that, you know, there's an upper end for the Democrats in this election. And I know that even saying this is sort of going to make people's heads explode. But, you know, we won 2018 by 8.5 points. And so I feel like the Republicans really made an enormous strategic error this cycle. And basically, you know this, Michael, they've been overtaken by extremists. I mean, the extremists have taken over the Republican Party. This won't be the case forever, but it's the case now. And voters don't want to go there. And I think the other thing that Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy made another enormous error, which is they didn't present any kind of positive agenda. They didn't lay out a 3-point plan that if you vote Republican, this is what you're going to get. They were so confident in their position, you know, with Biden's approval rating being so low and inflation being so high, that they didn't do what almost every political party does in a midterm election or a presidential election, say, if you vote for me, this is what you're going to get.
And well, so, yeah, it's what we did in 2010.
You did in 2010 is what you did in 1994, right? Yep. It's the classic playbook, right? And their arrogance and extremism and led them to make another strategic error, which has led them to a place where they have no closing argument any longer, right? They don't have a close. We have a very strong closing argument, right? Joe Biden came to Washington to get a bunch of things done. He got them done. He's united the party, right? The country's better off today. He's going to make all those arguments. What's the Republican closing argument? I don't want Donald Trump to go to jail. I mean, that's not a particularly compelling argument to swing suburban voters. There's no olive branch that Republicans gave. If, you know, I'm worried about MAGA. I mean, if you're worried about MAGA, you're more worried about MAGA today than you were in 2020. And so I think this is not only, I think the Republicans have created, you know, they're in the process of losing the election, in essence, right? I mean, right. They could have put this thing away. They could have run away with it. They've made enormous errors. And then finally, the other big set of things that have happened that we haven't talked about is, you know, is inflation coming down. And right. And so Republicans' ugliness became more apparent, polls shifted. But then the new dynamic, as you mentioned, is that Joe Biden's approval rating has gone up 9 points in the last few weeks. You know, he's closing strong. People are re-evaluating his presidency, giving him a new look, right? He's been able to do a lot of very meaningful things legislatively in the last few months. And so now we not only have the congressional generic shifting towards the Democrats, good high overperformance in these House and specials in Kansas, but now Biden's approval is coming way up. And it's moving up very rapidly. You know, it's like a point a week, right? And so if he's at 45, 46 on election day and not at 41, 42, you know, that's a big boost that he'll give to the Democrats. And so,
What do you make of this effort that seems, I think Republicans, if they're smart, then they've been following what you've been saying.
Yeah.
Not that they can do anything about it at this point, because I think you make the case that that barn door may have closed on on the horses that are trying to get back in. what do you make of this effort now that seemingly trying to develop, because Mitch McConnell at one point, to your earlier point, said, give us the power and we'll tell you what we're going to do.
Right.
That's a great way to it speaks to how arrogant they were in their belief that we got this. You know, we're going to take this. We got the House. That's ours. Now the question is how big of a margin we can rack up in the Senate. Right. And now all of a sudden the Senate is gone. McConnell's all but admitted that. That opportunity is lost. I think the Senate, I think Republicans see a net loss for them or gain for Democrats of anywhere from 3 to 5 seats potentially. But I tend to be a little bit more aggressive in my thinking than most. I'll admit that because I just read the tea leaves a little differently, yeah. Which leads me to look at the House and agree with you. I'm on the record of saying I see 7-8 seats pick up for Democrats, meaning they hold the House. So now you see Republicans making the shift, Simon, to, we're going to do a 2022 version of Contract with America. They've reemployed Newt Gingrich to sort of help them come up with those 75% issues that all Americans want. Well, okay, unless you begin to turn around your narrative on abortion, unless you're beginning to turn around your narrative on race, and unless you're going to be turn around your narrative on voting, you're going to turn around your narrative on immigration policy. Where do you see that effort at this point, 8 weeks out, now probably more like 7 weeks out going into November?
I think it's too late. I mean, I think it's going to feel tokenish and political to people, a half measure, not a serious measure. But let's see what they come up with. I mean, look, the advantage Republicans have right now is they still lead on the economy, which really matters, right? That is a their strength. They're down on a lot of other issues and issues that are consequential, but they still have a lead on the economy. And it's why in my own writing for the last year, I've been arguing to Democrats that we have to close that gap, that if we want to put this election away and win the election, we've got to close the gap on the economy. I still think that's going to be the central, one of the central battlegrounds of the final few months. It's where the Republicans have an advantage. It's where we have underperformed, I think, you know, literally and politically. I mean, and but the economy is much better. What you're seeing now, inflation's down to zero. Projections are now that inflation will be zero again next month, which means that real wages are actually up now for Americans. And, you know, gas prices today, oil, the international oil market, you saw a collapse of oil. And I read a piece today that in 50 different areas that the Fed measures for inflation, there's actually prices are dropping in the United States. And so we need, I think, in our close, and where if I were the Republicans, I would be fighting this centrally on the economy. That's where they right. is where they have an advantage. It's always number one, number two issue, right? I think a lot of these other things Newt's going to come up with, they may poll well, but nobody cares about them, right? This whole issue of saliency, there's a big difference between issues that are popular and issues that matter. And what you want to do is you want to have an advantage on the issues that matter. Abortion matters. We have enormous advantages there. For a lot of our voters, climate change really matters, particularly for younger voters. We have a huge advantage there on healthcare, right, which matters to a lot of people. We have a big advantage. Where do Republicans have an advantage on an issue that matters? It's on the economy. And so I do think that you are likely to see significant engagement back and forth in the economy in the closing months, because if we can take that away from them, then they got nothing. I think we may see that. I think you're going to see us continuing to press Social Security, abortion, so on. But I think you're going to see a more direct back and forth on, you know, has Biden made you worse off and have the Democrats made you worse off? I think we have a strong case to make, but we also have to make it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because you note in your blog, the Political Morning Consult data that, as you put it, helps shine a light on this dynamic you're talking about. You say, quote, for the GOP to have a good midterm, either many Democrats will have to stay home.
Yeah.
Or switch to the GOP, which is a very, I like the way you phrase that. Staying home is far less likely now, all right, because of the issues you've just talked about, climate and abortion being two leading indicators. I want to talk to you a little bit about the recent effort with the tuition reconciliation. Yep. Legislation and the sort of negative blowback on that, but we'll set that aside for the moment. This means the GOP, like I said, would need to give these voters a reason to come to them. So for those Democrats that stay home, the GOP has to give them a reason to come to them, or give Republicans a reason to come back. And what do voters see when they look at the two parties in Congress? And you know, the favorability rating, Dems in Congress is minus 11, ours is minus 23. Schumer has a positive 28%, McConnell 20. Pelosi positive 33%, McCarthy 21. I never thought that, you know, people would be applauding low positives. but the reality of it is those low numbers, you note the difference between the Republican leader and the Democratic leader, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. How do you see that? That speaks a lot to generic ballots for sure. Yeah. But how does that translate? How do voters translate that when they are expressing, I just don't like Kevin McCarthy. I just don't like Chuck Schumer more than I like Mitch McConnell. What does that mean?
Well, it goes to this basic idea that Republicans just haven't really given voters a reason to vote for them. I mean, on a very basic level, what happened in the last two elections, right, was, as we've discussed, is that people rejected MAGA. They gave the Senate, the House, and the presidency to the Democrats, right? Donald Trump was the first president since Hoover to lose all three of those things in his first term. And so, you know, there was a rejection of this politics. And what you see is that you see it in McCarthy and McConnell's poll numbers. You see it in the understanding of who the Republicans are in Congress. I mean, there was an awareness in the electorate that the Republican Party has changed and has changed for the worse. There was a poll that the Center for American Progress did back in April, which was the most comprehensive poll that I've seen about this issue of what's happened to the Republican Party. And what was interesting to me was that among independents, there was incredible understanding that the Republican Party had changed in recent years and then had changed for the worse, right? That their understanding was that this development around MAGA, it's not surprising, right? Independents voted against Republicans very heavily in the last two elections, right? So there was this awareness. This was not information we had to put into people's heads. We didn't need to use television advertising to explain why the Republicans were, why people didn't like Republicans, because they didn't like them and they never, you know, and where the Republicans, I think, made a huge error was that they overly discounted how unpopular the Republican Party was. And they believed they were going to be the old Republican Party and things were just going to snap back. And that's not what happened. And so there was this, as a friend of mine who's a consultant said, in focus groups, there was this muscle memory among independent voters about why they voted against Republicans. They brought it up themselves, right? This wasn't something we had to put into. So this was already in people's heads. And then Uvalde came. And then Roe ended, and the abortion restrictions, and January 6th, and Trump's repeated criminality, and all the things. And you look at that, and you think, this is the ugliest thing I've ever seen. I mean, I already didn't really like them very much. And now they want me to, they want me to come vote for that, right? And so I think what's happened is that there was this rejection, an immediate rejection, particularly when Roe ended, these dynamics really accelerated, right? And now the Republicans are in trouble. And I think what you're seeing, Michael, it's really interesting what you just said about what I had written about, which is the dynamic for Democrats was, or for Republicans was, they needed a big chunk of Democrats to switch to them, or people who had voted
right.
Democrats to switch to them or to stay home. We know from polling that our vote intensity now is equal to the Republicans, which is a big problem because we had more voters, right? They needed to be ahead of us in vote intensity. And then the question of, will people switch over? I think that's far less likely as well. And I think the real question now is, will some slice of non-MAGA Republicans, right, whatever that number is, it could be as much as 20% of the Republican Party, but let's say 3 or 4% of that coalition we were discussing earlier just isn't going to vote for MAGA, the MAGA candidates. They're not going to vote for Oz. They're not going to vote
Kerry for Kerry or anything like that.
Yeah, right. Or any of these guys. And then all of a sudden, that dynamic we're discussing is actually inverted, meaning that the question is now, will those voters who are not for MAGA, who are Republicans, stay home or switch over to the Democrats? And I think that what you're seeing in the low poll numbers, the fact that Republicans are at 41, 42, 43, suggests that they're really struggling to put their coalition back together, that MAGA-led candidates, there's resistance to them among traditional Republicans, non-MAGA Republicans. The question is, will those non-MAGA Republicans hold their nose and vote for the MAGA candidate? Will they stay home or will they vote Democratic? I mean, what's interesting is you've got somebody like Matthew Dowd, right? Who you know very well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, George Bush's pollster and consultant is now a Democrat. He's gone all the way over to the Democrats. Right. We've got Liz Cheney and folks, you know, the never Trumpers, folks like you who aren't Democrats, but you're not really excited about voting for Republicans. And right. What do the millions of Republicans
and Bill like Crystal's out here advocate, telling people y'all need to become Democrats.
Right. And so, I mean, what are the millions and millions of Republicans like you really end up doing? And I think what you're seeing in the polling is that they're not sure they're going to vote for these MAGA candidates. And that's why I think the Republican Party, I call it, you know, you're seeing the Republican Party crack up right now. It's splintering. And this is exactly, nobody anticipated this, right? I mean, 3 months ago, if I had said what we're talking about now, people really would have thought, they thought I was a little crazy. They would have thought really crazy. But you're seeing the splintering. Even today, go to Liz Cheney's Twitter feed. She goes after Ted Cruz in a more vicious way than almost any Democrats ever gone after Ted Cruz. And so you were seeing a war between MAGA and non-MAGA Republicans that is certainly going to be, is going to hurt the Republican effort this fall. There's no doubt about it. The question is how much.
Right.
And so I think that's, you know, part of the drama of what we're going to see in the next, you know.
So real quick, before we take a quick break here, So the coda on that begs the question, why then are we seeing polling from Republicans that show that, you know, Republicans at or above 50% and Republicans, you know, pushing this red wave narrative?
Yeah.
When objective data, irrespective of whether it's coming out of your shop, I mean, you can use 538 as a baseline. Yeah. You can use a number of other consult polls, et cetera, to do that, showing something very different. How Republicans seemingly much more of an outlier almost because it's not consistent with what we're seeing elsewhere.
It's really it's a really interesting question. And I think you actually know part of the answer to this is that, you know, there's really only one polling firm right now that's producing a steady stream of polls that are sort of out of this dynamic that I'm describing, where Republicans seem to be doing better. But what's interesting, it's Trafalgar, which is now, which is at a national level, has the Republicans ahead by 5 points, which is, you know, it's just not mathematically possible at this point for that to be the case. But, and part of what they do is that it's what they call, it's called a likely voter screen, and it's who they believe is going to vote. And what's very likely to happen is they probably still have Republican voters with greater vote intensity than Democrats, which means that their sample is coming back a little bit more Republican than a lot of the other samples. And so there's a way to do this where it still looks like a legitimate poll based on some of the assumptions you have about vote intensity. But we know that vote intent, Democratic vote intensity is very high. We know it from polling, but we also know it from these elections that just took place, right? Where we overperformed. Right. So the idea that, you know, we're overperforming in actual elections, you know, by 5-6 points and Republicans somehow are ahead by 5 points, it's just not real. And so even their polls, though, let's be very clear. I went back before we came on and I looked at some of, they just released a bunch of new polls this week. They don't even have Republicans at 50 in their polls, right? And so even the best Republican polling this cycle, right, the most pro-Republican polling has Republicans in, you know, at 47, 48, not at 51, 52, right? Mm-hmm. So even there, I would argue, given that we know Trafalgar is a few points probably more Republican than the norm right now, even those polls are not good. And in many cases, Democrats are still winning. Even in the best Republican polling, we're still winning by 4 or 5 points in many of these states. And so, you know, I just think, look, the argument you get a lot, and when I give my presentations, is, you know, hasn't polling been wrong? Wasn't there non-response bias in 2020? Well, you know, Michael, I mean, the way polling works is that when you've got 100 polls that are saying the same thing, it's very likely that that's where things are. And, and that's what we have. I mean, we have, you know, 90-95% of the polling is sort of pointing in one direction right now. And there's a few, there's always going to be outliers. What's interesting is there just aren't more than one or two outliers. It's not like there's 10 polls showing one thing and then 5 polls showing another. It's like 100 polls showing one thing and 2 or 3 polls showing another. Yeah. And so it's likely that the election is where we think it is. I mean, that's just my view, having done this for 17 election cycles. You know, polling is more likely to be right than wrong. But, and in 2016, because this comes up with Democrats all the time, you hear Democrats say, oh, but the polls were wrong in 2016. They weren't wrong. The election changed at the end, and they weren't wrong. And, but the election changed. Elections can change.
What do you mean by that? Explain to folks, when someone says the polling was wrong in 2016, and the response back is, no, the polling was right, but the elections changed.
Yeah.
People's eyebrows go, okay.
So it's,
say what?
Just go back to 538. 538 is actually written extensively on this, and they can show you that the day the Comey letter dropped, Hillary was up by 5.5 points. And then she dropped precipitously, immediately. There was an immediate drop in her in polling for her. And to the point where it got
so that's
down.
What you mean. So there was some external event that changed the direction of the course of that election, the trend line, if you will.
And that can happen in this election too.
Right.
And it can happen in every election. But all we can operate in, Michael, is what's likely.
Right.
What does the data suggest? It doesn't mean this is what's going to happen. It's just a snapshot. It's a window into time. And what's remarkable to me is how consistent the data and information is. And it's telling us the same thing.
So the data piece is an important component of that for sure. And how people interpret that data based on the events that come about. We're going to unpack a little bit more of that. We're going to also look at different angles on some of this information and what it may mean for 2022. After this very quick break, we'll be back with Simon Rosenberg.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody, here at Michael Steele Podcast. We're geeking out on some numbers and having a fun time doing
it.
This is a master class in understanding how the soup tastes so good, why it tastes so good, and how you make it, and what the end product ultimately is. There are a lot of ingredients that go into understanding how elections take place and how they form. And one of the things that I kind of chuckle at, and you and I've laughed about it, is while you're pushing this thought puzzle for people to kind of figure out and begin to understand that, as you said it before we went to break, you know, the results, the data is the data, but the election itself can change and it can have an impact there. You get a lot of pushback on that. and certainly most recently from one of Osted Wesley, who pushed back on a tweet that you put out back at the end of July, where you talked about, you know, it's hard to overstate how wrong the red wave take has been, right? And a lot of folks pushing this idea that there's this red wave. You're like, time out, people. This is not about what you wish or hope for. This is really about what is. And you say, when you look at Senate races, Fetterman, Warnock, Kelly, Cortez Mastro, Hassan, all have public polls at 49 or 50%, which goes to what we were just talking about relative to where the other candidates are. You know, there are polls with Rubio, Abbott, Kemp, Grassley in the 40s, and Johnson, Vance, Oz, Walker in the low to mid 40s. But then Osted pushed back, November victory laps based on summer polling that confirms priors and completely ignores House prospects. Election Twitter is back. Money, money, right? What I took away from that was not the slapback, which I believe missed your point.
Yep.
But how you responded to that, you were like, no, victory laps, no victory laps here, my friend. Repeatedly talk about how it's an opportunity, a competitive election. What the data is telling you is this is not a wave election for either party. This is really a competitive election for both parties. And the victory will go to the one that figures out just how competitive it really is.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little surprised by what he wrote because I thought it wasn't actually what I was saying. And
right.
I challenged him. I mean, in it. But the bigger point was that I think that there were a lot of people who were invested in the red wave narrative for a variety of reasons. And, you know, we were, as you and I have discussed, I mean, I don't think there ever was a red wave. It's not a question that there was a red wave and then things got better. I just don't think the wave ever happened. This has been a competitive election since I really started looking at the data back in May, and it's actually just gotten better for Democrats. And so, yeah, I mean, it's okay. I mean, there's no question that I had a lot of people questioning my sanity and wondering whether I had jumped the shark or whatever the right line is. I mean, I even did an interview on Matt Lewis's podcast in late June where he brought me on to say, dude, like, you're the only person saying what you're saying. I want you to come on my show. And he said, I don't want you to embarrass yourself, and so it was, but it's okay. I think that part of what you and I have talked about is that I think that because there were so many late Republican primaries this year and so many contentious Republican primaries, we had less independent polling data than we usually have. And so it meant that the data that people were looking at were Biden's approval rating and high inflation, and that other data, which told a different story, was being rejected in part because there just wasn't a lot of it, right? I mean, even Asted's comment about the House, we didn't have a lot of data about the House up until very recently. And I would tell you that if you go to 538 and you look at the House data, it shows a competitive election. You can't find evidence of a red wave there either, by the way. Which makes sense because it would be weird for the House to be operating in a completely different set of political dynamics than the governor's races and the Senate races, right? It's one election. And so I think part of this had to do with just a paucity of data, and an unwillingness. And I think, Michael, the other thing that happens, and you're a public figure and you know this, is that I think the penalty now in the age of Twitter and social media for breaking from the pack is much higher.
Oh my
And
God.
you know this because you break from the pack every day,
Oh
right?
my God.
And so I think there's now become of self, the herd journalism has become stronger, I think. And so I knew that what I was doing, I was just putting out my data every day. As you know, I do it almost every day on Twitter. And as things have changed, my analysis has changed. For me, luckily, all the changes have been positive for Democrats,
But
right?
not just that they're positive for Democrats. In tracking you and how you talk about it, Simon, it's been consistent. I mean, you can draw a line back to earlier data and show, oh yeah, this is how it's changed and why my analysis is still consistently that this is still a good cycle for Democrats.
Listen, I think that, Michael, you know this because you led a party's effort in a midterm. I'm very, very respectful and conservative about data because if I'm wrong, I can cause people to lose elections, right? The consequences of being
Hello.
wrong. Yeah. I mean, the consequences of being wrong about this stuff is people who I respect and admire, right, lose. And so that weighs very heavily on me every day. And it's why I'm very conscious of the fact that I can't stray one inch, from the data that I'm seeing. I can't push it past where it what it's telling me, because if I mislead people, if I give people a false impression and they take actions upon it, I can be responsible for really remarkable and good people losing their seats. I don't want to take, so I take every word that I write and every analysis I do it with a heavy burden on me, because I know, because I've been doing this a long time and I helped a lot of people get elected, that people read what I write and I need it to be correct.
Which
So
is
if I don't know, I don't say anything, right?
right.
I don't have opinion. There are a lot of things I don't have opinions about because I just don't know. On this stuff, I know this stuff, and I know what it's telling us. And we have a competitive election here. And I would rather be us than them. I'd rather be Democrats right now than
The
Republicans.
Republican, which is
As
why,
yeah.
going back to our point, the point you made in our in the last before the break. Which is why, when you have Republican polling firms juicing the polling to pay for the charge that they've just imposed on their client, because I'm telling you, that's a big part of it. It got me into trouble at the RNC because I would not play that game and I didn't want to deal with those vendors who were like, we can give what do you want the poll to say? I'm like, I want the poll to tell me what's really happening. I don't need bullshit poll. And that's why you had Karl Rove freaking out in the 2020 election because they had sold all this crap to their donors that Donald Trump was winning this election when they knew damn well he wasn't, when the narrative, this election was over in July of 2020. That 2020 election, when I looked at it, I was telling people, nope, this is done. Now the question is just how many millions of Americans are going to vote, as you indicated in the last conversation. Do they shift more towards the Dems? Do they stay home? But their minds are made up. That's an important piece here. When you're looking at the 2022 data, is you've got to be honest about what it's telling you, which goes to my point about it being a competitive race, and the victory is going to go to the candidate and the party that understands that principally. So how do Democrats screw this up?
Well, I don't.
Because there is a high propensity on your side of the aisle for that. I just want to know, in light of everything that you shared, how the Democrats can still screw this up and snatch defeat out of the jaws of potential victory in races that would give them not just an advantage in the Senate, but possibility of holding the House.
So I'm going to give you sort of an answer that's probably going to surprise you, but let me give you the answer. Up until a week ago, my greatest fear was that we didn't understand that we could win the election. Mm-hmm. That the thing that we were screwing up was actually that we had lost, that there had been so much infighting in the Democratic Party and so much, you know, negative energy inside our family that many of the people, and we were losing, you know, and we were, Biden's approval rating was down, and we were overly reliant, I think, as a Democratic Party on that measure. And so I think that up until very recently, I was worried that we weren't going to shift into going on offense and that we were going to play defense. And it would have meant that we may have actually come up short in the House because we weren't really trying. We weren't in the mentality that we could win. I think last week, the victory in New York 19 changed all that. Mm. I think that this was a sea change in the internal understanding inside the Democratic operative.
Tell people a little bit about that race.
This is really important because I think this is one of those intangible, nerdy political things. But, you know, I talked to the I was a senior strategist for the DCCC in 2018, and I was involved in creating the strategy that flipped the House. It was our first big victory against Trump and MAGA in 2018. So a very consequential election. And we won by 8.5 points. I mean, it was a big win when we didn't do as well in the Senate and many other races around the country. And so I have this basic belief about politics that if you're not on offense, you're losing, and that you've got to be on offense relentlessly all of the time, pressing your advantage, you know, taking up space, making the other side respond to you. You know, if you're a soccer fan, it's like, you know, it's the high press in soccer.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever you want to call it. Right. And so I can tell you. So last week I talked to the DCCC. We had a special election in New York for two House seats that were competitive. And in New York 19, which was a Democratic leaning seat, our polling had us down 3. Right. In our internal polling, there were other polls that had us down 10, but there were no polls showing us ahead. And I talked to my colleague at the DCCC that afternoon. And I said, what do you think is going to happen tonight? And she said, we're going to lose by 3 or 4 points. And we're okay with that. We're comfortable with that outcome. So they believed they were going to lose by 3 to 4 points. And we won by 2.5 points. Mm. And so that when that happened, what the DCCC and all the operatives were like, you know what? I mean, we've now had Kansas, Nebraska, you know, Minnesota, New York, where when we actually go vote, we're outperforming our polling.
Right.
And so that point, they're like, okay, we got a shot here. I mean, there was I think they were getting ready to believe they could win. Now the House Democrats think they can win this election. And they're going to, and it's going to change the way they do ad spending. Michael, you know what that means, right? It means a lot, right?
It's a big deal, folks.
And where they allocate their spend.
Yeah.
And how nervous they get if somebody
can I just real quick on your point, put it in context so folks understand contextually what you're saying about what this means and how the party responds. I give you the Senate, the Republican Senatorial Committee pulling out of Pennsylvania.
And not
making the spins on behalf of their Senate candidate that they now the numbers are telling them we're not going to win. Dr. Oz is not going to win this seat. The same, you know, you look at it competitively in Ohio. You look at it where they are in Wisconsin. You look at where they are in a number of these races, and the reallocation of resources is always a leading indicator of how the party is viewing their chances.
Well, let me give you an example of this, right? You're saying, so in Ohio, we never thought that election was going to be competitive. I'm just telling you right now, people, you know, I talk to folks who run these things, right? They always thought that Vance would consolidate the Republican base and that. So Republicans are having to spend now $30 to $40 million in Ohio because, you know, Ryan has made this a competitive election and Vance is a terrible candidate and is really struggling. I mean, that's $30, $40 million they don't have to put into other races that they didn't know they were going to have to spend.
That they need to put that money into. Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that happens in an election at the end, which is, you know, I got an email from the DCCC, for example, right, where they sent us Democrats who do this stuff for a living, you know, hey, we've got 10 races where our candidates don't have as much money as they want, right? And we need you to give to these 10 races. A month ago, that would have been all incumbent Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
This one, 8 out of the 10 were challengers against Republicans. And there's no way in the world they would have been asking for money for challengers a month ago. And that shows how much the mindset is changing. They're on offense now. They're trying to pick up seats in the House.
Right.
And so there's been a confidence boost, right? And you know, the team's gotten a jolt. Like, you know, it's like scoring a goal late in a game or something where you now think you can go, you tie the game late, now you want to go win it, right? That's where we are as a party, and we're very hungry. We're raising lots of money. Our voters are very engaged. And, you know, it's, and keep in mind that, you know, one of the things that's happened is that because a lot of the energy that is at post Roe is with college educated women, that means tens of millions more dollars for us as well. I mean, there's a direct translation into not just more voting and more volunteerism, but a lot more money. Because these are better off people, right, who can give $1,500, right? So I feel like we've got the wind at our back. I'd rather be us than them. And I just want to say one last thing. I don't know how much more time we have.
I want to dovetail on that.
Okay, go. Then you take it.
Let me dovetail on that wins in the sail thing because, you know, yes, Democrats have the wind in their sails, but they also have been known to turn the sails unnecessarily. And even though they still have the wind, they now make it more difficult. And that issue, one of those issues potentially is the student loan forgiveness. How do you see that as an issue going into this fall? The advantage for Republicans to sort of prey on the anger that some voters have who paid their debts back, didn't have the benefit of loan forgiveness, struggled to do that. And now watching, you know, those who've made that same commitment get forbearance and relief and the unfairness of that. So do you see that as an issue sort of taking the wind out of the sails for Democrats?
I don't think we know the answer to your question yet. There isn't enough independent data, but let me try to give you my best guess, right?
Okay.
At this point, just given what I have seen. Is that I think it's not going to be a major issue in the election because I think there's so many other things that just are more important. It doesn't mean that it's not important. It's just there's other things that are more important for voters. And I think for the voters who it's really important for is the people who are getting the relief and their families. And, you know, and so I think what you're seeing is for Democrats as we head into the midterms, you know, young people are the least likely to vote of our coalition, and they're overwhelmingly Democratic, 15 to 20% more Democrat than Republican. And what's happened in the last few months is that Joe Biden, who was doing terribly with young voters, there's enormous distance between Joe Biden and young people because of his age and other things, right? Is that he, I think we've really put together a very powerful offering for young people. The combination, you know, that I think young people are through the climate legislation, which is a voting issue for many young people, with the student loan issue, which is a voting issue for many young people, coupled with the abortion issue, which disproportionately affects young people, the gun safety legislation, which was the first bipartisan gun safety legislation in 30 years, we now can go to young people and say, look, we've heard you. We're doing things that matter to you and your families.
Right.
And we're also going to protect you from things that could do harm to you and your families. I mean, you and I discussed this the other day, but, you know, if you're a 24-year-old woman in Texas, you know, and abortion is now your life. Now there's a 10% chance that if you have a miscarriage, you know, my wife had a miscarriage. Many of us have lived in families where, you know, moms have had miscarriages, right? It's a very common thing is that if there's a 1 in 10 chance, if you have a miscarriage, that you could end up dying on a table in a hospital. You know, you may never vote Republican ever again. And I think that's the final point. So I will say on the student loan thing, there is some polling today. The Morning Consult, Politico showed it slightly favorable for Democrats. So I don't think it's going to be enough to do harm. I think many of the people that will be angry about it were already not voting for us in all likelihood. I don't know that we're going to lose any voters. And I will just say is that if you really are fair-minded about the next 8 to 10 weeks, it's far more likely that something happens to Republicans that harms them than it is to Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, one more
legal problem for Donald Trump,
or Rudy gets indicted or whatever.
Another senator come out like Lindsey Graham's telling us that, you know, if you hold Trump accountable for his actions, that there will be blood in the streets, and Americans do not respond favorably to those kinds of threats.
As a political operative, I have no idea how to defend the Republican Party right now. I mean, I wouldn't have any idea of how to deal with all the criminality, illegality, and how do you defend forcing a 10-year-old to have a baby? I mean, these are things that are, you know, there's a reason. Look, this is the final thing I wanted just to lay out there, just as a thought experiment. So let's say the Republicans are at 46, 47, and let's say that, you know, once the real understanding in the public about the abortion restrictions take place and this sort of medieval effort to deny women's sort of basic freedoms that, I mean, in virtually every country in the world, you know, abortion is legal. This feels medieval to me. Imagine if that hurts the Republican Party by 1 or 2 points structurally over the next 5 or 6 years. And let's say that all these criminality and Trump's, you know, causing one of the greatest security breaches in the history of the United States and trying to overturn an election, let's say all that stuff congeals into eroding the Republican brand by another 1 to 2 points, right? Now you're talking about a Republican Party that's sitting at 42, 43, not at 45, 46, 47. And I will tell you that I think that's the likely scenario. I think the degradation to the Republican brand that could continue to happen over a long period of time. And basically the way to think about it is that, man, did they screw up?
Right.
I mean, they screwed up big. I mean, they defended this crazy guy. They defended the overturning an election. They defended, you know, him stealing government secrets and lying about it to the FBI. It's not just that he did these things. It's that the Republican Party backed him in these things.
Mm-hmm.
Those things could cause enormous structural brand damage to the Republican Party beyond what's already been done. And so I think that there is, when we're looking forward over the next few years, you know, there could be, Democrats could be up 8-10 points structurally in national politics for a while, because they've made a lot of big errors that could cost them with voters for a long time.
So last point before I let you go, because you just led into it. How does what you're seeing now, the trend lines in the polling, as you just indicated, there's some real potential positives for Democrats if they don't screw it up. How does that set up the 2024 conversation? How does what we see now, what likely could happen in November, set up voter attitudes going into 2024?
Well, my hope is that if we do win the election and we win the House and Senate, we keep the House and Senate, that it will begin a serious conversation in the Republican Party about moving away from MAGA and Trump.
Right.
I mean, that's my hope, because it's good for the country for the Republicans to abandon MAGA and to become conservative again. I'm happy with a conservative Republican Party.
Right.
You know,
the water's fine, conservatives. Yeah, come on in. You know, you don't have to do MAGA, baby. Right, come on in.
You know, and just a center right. A mainstream center-right political party.
Right, exactly. It worked. It worked for 160 years. It works.
Yeah.
Come on.
But MAGA is dangerous, and so my hope is that, you know, there's a sense that, hey, being MAGA, we keep losing elections and we've got to try something different. My hope, that's why I think Democrats winning the House and Senate this time, which may be painful for many Republicans, may in the long run be the best thing for the Republican Party, because it will accelerate the eventual, I hope, right, coming to senses of, you know, the party of Lincoln and Reagan and returning back to a constructive, positive force in our national life, which it just simply isn't right now. And that's my hope. And that's why I think the stakes in this election are so high. I mean, we could be on the verge of doing really significant damage to MAGA. And that's in some ways the most important thing for all of us, because MAGA is a threat to our democracy.
It is.
It's a threat to our prosperity. It's a threat to the West. I mean, imagine if the Republicans won the House and Senate and pulled the United States out of the conflict with Russia and forced a retrenchment. I mean, the consequences of Republicans taking over in this next election could be world altering, not just. And so I'm hopeful that the uncommon sense, good sense of the common people is prevailing once again. And it's why I, you know, am doing everything I can to make sure that we not just have a competitive election, but that we win. And I do think that, Michael, as we said earlier, and I appreciate your understanding, because, you know, you helped lead your party to victory in 2010. You know what has to happen is that you got to believe, you know, and yeah. I think we believe now, and we're out of the defensive crouch. And I think the thing that is sort of most extraordinary to all of us is what's happening with Biden's approval rating, which is, you know, galloping upwards. And which means that, you know, that downward pressure is being alleviated
at least a little bit.
Yeah. And so listen, I'll just say to your viewers, I'm great. You've given me a lot of time today. I appreciate it. And whatever flavor of Democrat or Republican you are, you know, this is an election where it really matters. And so voting, giving money, volunteering, whatever you're going to do, do more of it. Be a big citizen. Close strong for your country. And let's hope that we can have the kind of outcome that will be the best thing for our kids, you know. And I'm more optimistic today that we may get there than I was a few weeks ago.
Well, you just closed strong for us, my friend. I appreciate you for taking the time to come on. I love for people to understand exactly how this works and how their attitudes and their views are captured by guys like you in order to help and explain to the political organs that they affiliate with why they need to pay attention to the American people and yeah. Don't take for granted anything that the American people are telling you, because as you noted, you know, things change and they change rapidly. And at the core of that change are the American people. Yeah. Simon Rosenberg, thank you so much. He is the president of NDN, New Democrat Network, and the New Policy Institute. I like to call him a buddy and certainly a partner in this crazy, crazy game of politics, even though he stands on the other side of the aisle. We stand together for democracy. And that's an important matter right now as we go into this November elections. So thank you, my man, for coming and sharing some data, some knowledge and some information.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And maybe we can do this again in October and do a check-in.
I was going to say, you will be back, my friend. We're going to do a check-down on where we are as we head into the witching hour in October to get a sense of whether both of us will be looking for another line of work or you know, actually laying down some smart knowledge.
I just want to say thank you for your courage and your you know, bravery. I think about all of you a lot, because, you know, I'm a moderate Democrat and I've occasionally been in some of the inner party wars on my side. And I don't know if I could have done what you've done.
No, I appreciate that very, very much. You know, I tell people that's why I'm still a Motel 6 Republican. Someone's got to keep the lights on. Someone's got to keep the lights on. So, well, that does it for this time together, folks. If you like the podcast, tell a friend for sure, and certainly give us a review on Apple Podcasts. Check us out on Spotify as well. You can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele and the podcast Twitter at Steele_podcast. And you can check out my man, Mr. Rosenberg, on his website, on his Twitter, which is at Simon WDC. Check it out. All of his stuff is there, his information. You can click on the links. He puts everything up, and he shows his work. And that's important for a guy like him in his business. So there's never any question. He doesn't hide the ball. And that's why I follow him and consider him a primary source for understanding exactly where you are as voters. Until next time, be safe, be well, take care. God bless. Summer's at an end, baby. Next time we meet, it'll be Memorial Day. It will be in the fall. And thank God the heat will be done, right? Oh, the climate change. Oh, that's a whole nother podcast. Until next time, take care.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.